beten geht dann.
Everybody knows PMG.
When in fact there are the realities of such
I think Mama Albert Moore already taken to be saying that looking at the report really at a certain stage, a certain act, how do other people with this concern? Be that as it may, the community looking at us, it doesn't know the nitty-gritty. We have to do more with the less we have. I didn't hear anything mentioned about traditional medicine. We like or not, the traditional medicine is there, and we have to accommodate them somewhere so that we work together. Because if we don't do that, they will do whatever they do. If it doesn't come well, it will come at our doorstep. The other one, I didn't see a percentage. I just taken that this list of immunization coverage at 90% includes rural areas. I want to know that. The last one, I think the department, it is time to look at our essential drug list. The essential drug list, whereby I think it is an important policy whereby it helps the nurses at primary health care to it guide the nurses. But I think we should review whereby the primary health care nurse has referred the patient to the doctor. The doctor who is visiting the clinic, who is expected to use the very same essential drug list. And if there is no drug, that drug is not at the primary healthcare essential list. The doctor has to refer the patient to another level, solely for an alternative drug. Hence, I think the suitcase, I think all the doctors know what I'm talking about. That suitcase. And it should be monitored so that the doctor, the patient shouldn't move 100 and something kilometers just to go to the hospital so that he get the drug which is not in the primary health care. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have 56 questions here.
Mr.
Chairperson, you know, if you understand healthcare, there are three components to it. One is actually provision of service and the maintenance thereof. But there are two other components, and I would like to know what has been done in that. The first component is income generation. I didn't hear anything about income generation, and I want to place on record that I have a vested interest to hear about this, because we started a public-private partnership in my small district or certain in Italy, and a study has been done by the MSF, which is a published study, which shows that we generate 9.2 million grants a year. But to generate that 9.2 million grants, you have to spend 1.6. Now, in the absence of revenue retention, that actually decreases my 1.6 million. So it doesn't make economic sense for me to start generating income when it doesn't come back because there's no revenue retention. So I'd like to know about the strategy about revenue generation, revenue retention, and the ability to generate income also. I ask this in light of the question that, you know, the majority of the hospitals, and especially hospitals situated in inaccessible areas, are run by the department. I know it's a provincial function, but run by our department. And one business that has been consistently showing huge profits, maybe the representatives from Mediclinic, but the private hospitals have been showing a consistent profit of over 28%. We can give you that. In our own department, in the Council for Medical Schemes, we did a study to show what income can be generated from income generation. And that study has been, and that was the idea why we formed them. So I would like to have some idea about income generation, income retention, and what is the potential to earn income. So I can ask specific questions, but I'd like to keep my question broad. My second concern is, how do we reduce expenditure? Because if we keep spending and we spend money the way we are spending money, we will continue to generate the same amount of expenditure, and if we do not introduce efficiencies into it, then we get into trouble. I raise this question in view of the fact that, and there are many manufacturers here who will tell you also if you have some private meetings with them, the cost of medicine in South Africa, cost of drugs in South Africa is on average much higher than other countries that I can name. Dasarola Chaudhary in Bangladesh and in India, they reduce the cost of medicine to the extent that they reduce the cost of 80% of what it was when they look at it. And taking our own consideration of improving our manufacturing sector, where from that it came back, we should look at this. Is there any plans to decrease the cost of medicine in view of the fact that we have got agreements like Pixar and others like that, because that's the other thing. My third concern, and it's a real concern for me because it contributes to efficiency. You cannot, it's in South Africa, it is almost impossible to measure outcomes for the money that we spend because you cannot do outcome reviews because we do not have enough encounter details, and it is coming increasingly clear that the postponement of our budgeting for a national information, health information system is actually detrimental to the health services. To the extent we will find ourselves spending more money, because I know of three provinces that have already gone ahead and implemented systems, and if these systems cannot talk to each other, do not have similar platforms, we're going to end up with duplication and spending more money trying to integrate systems. So I think at some point in time, one would need to have a look at those things to make sure that we do not do this. And so to me, if we're going to be serious about NHI and its implementation also, a national health information system becomes almost a priority that we would need to look at. And we need to do some things to make sure that has happened. Lastly, I got many questions, but maybe we'll go for a second one. I'm going to give a lot of water to chance there also. The issue of cost-benefit studies and certain interventions that need to take place to bring back cost-benefit. One of the things we have done in tobacco to say, if we go and legislate against tobacco, what are the benefits of it in chronic diseases? I think in substance abuse and in alcohol abuse, there's irrefutable evidence and studies that have been done to show what is the cost of trauma in South Africa in terms of road accidents, in terms of violence, and in terms of violence against women and children, and the contributing factor of alcohol. Now, if one looks at cost-benefit ratios, one could possibly look at mechanisms. If we put in effective legislation, there would be savings that and that could also help to contribute towards the division of banks. I know it wouldn't contribute directly to both 14, but at the provincial level that needs to happen. So therefore that should take priority to a great extent, and I'm worried about the alcohol use and the now increasing use of substances, sick and others, by young children just want to take an adverse effect. I'd like to stop the paper from that, but I have a chance I can come back to other questions.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to DG and the ACTCFO for this session. It's very informative. I won't repeat obviously the questions that you've asked, but I just want to ask a few others. Just one concern by many people regarding the additional money that was asked for with regards to the ARV program and OSD specifically. With the ARV program, is it going to reduce your target to how many people you'd like to be on the program? I take it then that everyone who's on the program will remain on the program and receive, continue to receive ARVs. But does this mean that people who should qualify for ARVs won't be receiving ARVs? And can you give some indication if yes, you know, to what scale? And as far as OSD is concerned, I understand your own negotiations with the department and the Treasury. Would you say
where is that going to start? It also leads to that mid next year, June cut-off date, those provinces, electoral colleges will then reopen. I think that we will have a very policy move. On that check, I want to know those are part of the presentation. I don't know what is the department's view on how nurses are recruited in particular. I'm raising this because in my process is that there's something that is pretty disturbing to some of us, that nurses post advertised on a newspaper. In the newspaper, those young women and men who are interested in health, there were some of them in these big rural areas, don't have an opportunity even to buy that newspaper. Is the department in looking into reopening of the nursing colleges also going to change and talk to those institutions like Elita and that? We're seeing that, Chair, I think we are hoping that must change. We can't have a situation of that. It was disadvantaging a number of young women and men who want to learn their services in the public sector.
And we have your ambassador to the last one, and then we can come back.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. A very informative presentation. Most of the questions have been asked, and we are ready about it. We are ready about it, particularly about the gap in terms of the financial constraints that we need, particularly HIV/AIDS, what it means for Christmas and what it means to our community. I will just go through 2 points. On page 15, page 14 actually, it says establish a well-capacity and optimal standard of compliance. Previously, we used to have what is called an accreditation system, where hospitals have been accredited. On page 15, it talks about the on-bus office. We used to have block and system type of a process. So my question to the two is that, are we replacing the old systems or problems that we had with new ones? And if so, how does that happen? Was there any problem with the previously used accreditation system? And if there was a problem, wasn't there any way for us to fix the problem, not to identify it, rather than coming up with a new process or a new system? Because I find that most of the time we come up with new things, you never go back and maybe try to rectify whatever system we had before and continue with them. And then another thing on the very the hospital management point. As some said, actually from Tristan Galvana Hospital, that's where I went to find him salary. We used to have a lot of arguments with the executive committee to say, okay, with the performance that we're getting in the hospital. One of the debates that I raised was to say, if nationally or in parliament or government, we can look at the issue of saying who should actually be CEOs of hospitals. Should they be people with finance background? Should it be a doctor? Because we find that we've got problems in terms of procurement. If it's a finance person, all of us, we're looking at the PSMA because we all don't want to be overspending or spending, you know, fruitlessly. The doctor will probably, I'm not saying he has spent more on doctors' issues, you know, because they know operationally that they really need that in operation theater. Then, on the other hand, if it's the finance person, there will be too much on the finance side to say, according to the PSMA, we cannot do blah, blah, blah. These people are not knowledgeable in terms of in-theater, especially when they're what is needed. And remember, a hospital system is very expensive. So we find most of the time, I mean, this contributes to the understanding and necessary. So those are my questions for now. We'll come to the second one.
Thanks, sir. I also appreciate the presentation from the department. I have no questions to ask, but I'm going to ask only two other members. My first question is about you talked about the improvement on remuneration of medical personnel. Now I'm concerned about the time frame, and also you talked about the service, and noting that the doctor's side has got a big percentage of 50%. And they are demanding that the percentage should be so big, And as the president also mentioned in the state of the nation address that this must be given priority. Now, what is the strategy now concerning that? How do you make this breakdown when I talk about treaties? And yes, of course, I don't see what preempt to the negotiations of the broadcast and the only department. But I'm concerned about that because that percentage is too high. Also, it needs an event. It must be considered as a matter of agency to be treated as such. My second question is on plan 4.5, bullet number 3. Bullet number 3. In that bullet, there is a recruitment of health professionals. I'm concerned that we are recruiting foreign professionals more than the local professionals. Now, why don't, if we're talking about the partner, PPPs, if we say we want to put PPPs in progress, why don't, therefore, we strengthen the local professional recruitment strategy so as to attack the private sector, which they say, most of them, yes, we want to work in partnership, we want to go to public health, but we are concerned about the issue what is going on, because we notice that only the foreigners are taken as the priorities in this country. I thank you.
This is, I suppose, we are not the only one, but you share the responsibility, but you must understand that the way we are brought up, people don't take us, and we are accountable to them. So some of the questions that we're asking you are basically from that. One of the things that I don't want you to be as well as that I'm saying, I looked at your program. There's, I think, two campaigns which get the biggest amount of national. But one thing that is worrying, you will always hear us talking about provinces because I'm sure what is happening. Now, one would imagine that in national, more money should be on monitoring these provinces than on other things, because that's not what you can, but the program that has got the biggest prices is not the one that does monitoring of the program. There are other ones that you need to tell us. I looked at your budget, there is nothing that talks about emergency budget, where all of a sudden you hear that the cholera is involved, and then you've got to run around looking for money for cholera. Or then something happens in Eastern Cape where kids start dying and you run around looking for money to do that. But there's no budget that I've seen here that's actually put on that. Maybe if you can enlighten us as to what actually happened. And so I want to give another answer.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the members for the questions for the 25 question. I find first of all, on the old revenue, income generation, revenue retention, I think those fall into one category. At the moment, there is and this issue relates to provinces themselves. So in other words, we have a different policy in relation to revenue retention, for example, prevailing in one province as compared to another. How can you say, look, we'll agree to a revenue retention strategy, provided you are meeting this target in terms of revenue, whatever you move beyond the guarantees in this case. It's the case may not be that. So, it's as part of our fiscal arrangement. These are interactions between provinces about how we use revenue. Remember that revenue when it comes to government, must come to the fiscal assembly. And it's only at that level that decisions are made. So, in other words, we don't have a national decision about revenue retention yet. This is a broad policy. That would be something that Treasury would have to deal with and not be able to request that there's a tough policy on revenue retention, but they are likely to encroach on provincial decision making. Those are provincial money according to the threshold. So at national level, the only income we have is the some minds together. They would say, what proposal would we come with to the session? Particularly in the context of our sister government, where they cannot really impose some of the Secondly, on the issue of concern, we know that many members have expressed some concern with regard to the budget issues that were presented as such. But we, at the same time, we do want to say that as we are presenting this, we are also looking at other ways of solving the problem, because some have to do with our engagement with Treasury to say that this actually has to be. For example, in relation to your AI budget, and particularly ALP budget, we have a very vigorous discussion with Treasury about those issues. First of all, in relation to the fact that we're always going to have over expenditure. Anyway, even if you give us 300 million and the patients come in, they will have to be treated because of the constitutional issues that are related to that. So if we are going to have that kind of problem, then people then will start taking defensive mechanisms because they are accountable for all that. Part of the defensive mechanism will be to then put on the table in writing that they are going to overspend. So they're going to tell you anyway that they're going to overspend. So in a way, to avoid that kind of thing, we need to find mechanisms. And we all recognize, especially with ourselves, we all recognize that there must be some kind of a sustainable solution for dealing with the demand on the system in relation to HIV and other related mechanisms. So we are working on it. One of the ways of looking at it is to see how, as I said, the donor community can support if we streamline the way they support so that you are able to actually prioritize and the lives of the people. So to honorable what the program has said at the moment remains with the people that are in the program. And that we have actually ensured and will sustain that. The issue under discussion at the moment is in some provinces where HOPs are now put and of course if you are an HOP in that situation, you are doomed if you do, you are doomed if you don't. If an HOP says, I'm not going to take any new people to treat, then everybody has an answer. And of course, what he's doing is in line with the law. He is not overspent when he's aware that he's overspent. But at the same time, it's in conflict with other laws that would actually say those people have a right. And by that's where you find the conflicting decision that has been made by this HOP. So you find that we have to deal with that contact and come in and intervene. But from the perspective that of God, they will be able to put new people into the program. Whether they'll be able to put the number of people that need to be into the program is the question that will be ongoing discussion. So in a nutshell, the current people will sustain. New people will be put in the program in terms of the amount that are made in the NDF. However, there is a limit to which they can do that, and therefore that's what we're actually convinced about. In some instances, already those new people that were projected for the next financial year are already. So what you see as projected for the next financial year is already consumed. And therefore, they have to look at how to deal with the new demand that is coming. So, in a nutshell, we are trying to manage the situation as best we can to ensure that patients do not suffer. And we've done that also with the stakeholders helping us in some instances. So it comes up with our issue on it. Now, with regard to some of the specific issues, traditional medicine, yes, we didn't, as I said, we actually picked up on the 10-point plan, but there are other specific issues here. On page 76, for example, of the program, you see, and of this statistic plan, you'll see that we talk about the institutionalization of African medicine into the National Health Service. and they are programmed with the character. So it's not spoiling off, the invitation coverage does include pluralism. It includes the, we're talking about the country, so when you say 90%, we mean 90% of the country, including the pluralism in the area. And in fact, most of those districts that we're talking about, the 18 districts, most of them are rural. Only one or two cases would be urban. So we are very much conscious of that. The matter of the EBL, first of all, I say at first I thought you said must review the list itself, but when you spoke I realized that you were talking about what exactly is stored and available at what level rather than the list itself. And of course, I think it's a service delivery issue we have to look into, because our sense is that 90% of the medication required at the primary health care level is available or should be available. In fact, we argue that there shouldn't be any stock-up beyond 90%. In other words, stock-up should be less than 10%. And if it is beyond that, then the problem is that, because we hear many stories, in fact, we have a problem, but you have a report that says, well, there was no medication in the clinic. And then you ask the problem, and they say, well, we don't have stock-up, 90% stock. Everything is in the time, because that's the time. So we need to close that channel. And one of the reasons why we are really talking about this information is so that we can be able to proceed at a certain point and say, what is the story of that clinic or that clinic or the other? But the issue that you are raising of how we can then close the gap, we will look into the terms of the possibility. There are other implications, of course, in terms of the scheduling of medicine. That makes that medicine much less in the clinic itself. Let me take the issue of the medical life insurance and say that, you see, we work on the basis of our legislation. If we know that by the end of this month, or by mid-July, we'll be able to have taken to cabinet policy proposals for public, public comment takes 3 months to comment on the government. There may be eventualities where, as a result of that public comment, things may change. But we don't plan that. We say, to take 3 months, give and take. And then, even if that legislation can be held better this time, we'll also take 3 months for public comment. The fact that even if you were to say one after the other, you would have 6 months. And then the executive will finalize it. So give or take, no interruptions in the process. That's from the policy planning point of view. You plan for the 3 month period of public comment and the 3 month period of public comment on the law. So therefore, I say by March 2010, we should have finished the policy proposal. Nothing. Maybe that people may say, no. We need a total review of this, of what you published, the first outline paper, and therefore you must publish another one. They would have to use the legal route to do that, and then we do that. So it could take longer. But from a planning point of view, just plan as the law allows for it. And that's what we're going to do. And to answer you, then there will be a draft for it. At the moment, there is no paper. The government doesn't have any paper at the moment. As soon as it becomes government documents, presented to cabinet for public comment, that's when we begin to engage, because that's not a government issue. At the moment, that's why we don't say anything about it, because we don't know it, but it's being discussed. It's just another story that exists. But once it becomes government, then it will be presented in terms of law. So that's why, what gives me the guarantee is planning. If I plan, I would say give or take, that's what the law requires me to do, so by March, I will tell you. But beyond that, there may be other eventualities which I can't plan for. So that's what we're actually doing now.
actually are a distortion of the reality. And
If you begin to say, what exactly are we dealing with when we say OSP? Then it's the fact that that's what we're talking about, things that are different. How the members are approaching this. As if we're talking about a salary increase of 50%. But Dr. Machado is doing that. I've tried to combine some of these for the diaspora. Now, with regard to the issue of opening of nursing colleges, as I said, yes, the matter was on the agenda, in fact, in the previous presentation. And in terms of that state of the legislature, if you ask problems, what did you do? They say we finished the opening of college. Because indeed they did. But that's the issue is, that's why I said, if we understand the opening of colleges as the fact that each male hospital there was a nursing college before, and we must now reopen that college. And that's the understanding that we need to actually start. Because in some instances, for example, here in Western Cape, the college was integrated into the university, and the infrastructure became the infrastructure of the university, for example. Now, to go and reopen it would mean something else. You won't be able to just take it from the university. You have to then look at other options of that, re-establishing the college. That's the first thing that you need to do. Secondly, one of the things that we need to look into is what kind of training are you talking about? Because if you look at now the scope of practice and therefore also the training that is now being developed by the nursing council, it's suggesting that certain levels of training should happen at a certain level, and other levels should happen at other levels. So when you open the college, it's not the same as what you're opening yesterday. Because it now has to fit into the new qualification framework that is actually coming in from the standard generation policy. So all those issues have to be factored. That's why our notion of opening colleges is not simply physically going to open that college. Because if we have that notion, then we'll take more time anyway, because some of them will not be opened. What do you open when, in fact, the other one is becoming home affairs office? As there are no tutors and so on. So we see that concept in Gotham, in terms of saying, let's look at the training of nurses in South Africa today, and how we establish the college sector, so that it actually becomes a stronger sector too, apart from the training and the entire education. That's what I'm saying. And that, you can never hesitate to do it in three provinces. Then we have actually had a clear policy framework, which we are doing this year. So by next year, we will give the specific target now, based on that policy, to say that then the provinces will be ready. This is in their budget, and they open two colleges, here, five colleges, or what it is. Or reopen those in that hospital. I can see the chair is speaking about hospital material. Those kinds of things, we will be able to look at. For example, one of the issues that is emerged here is that the colleges or the training of nurses has shifted from being a kind of stipend or salary based training to a bursary based training. So in other words, now you have a bursary funding student. And the notion of reopening colleges goes with that. It goes with saying, but we want to have those nurses to be paid as they are being paid. Which is how you got many of our hospitals having nurses at that level. If that is what we are going to do as a college, then we must also look at what are the implications for rearranging the budgets and ensuring that the provinces can work it into their budget. So all those things are not simply about opening the business and that's why we say it must be understood in the process. In the accreditation system of a super thing, and then I'll end up. The accreditation system. First of all, we didn't have an accreditation formally. We have COSAPA, which is a kind of independent voluntary system, which accredits by hospitals. That was on the basis of any government policy. It's an independent body that has been working with hospitals to do accreditation. What the implications of that accreditation are, or should be is not in quality. So if, you know, people like to have that accreditation, and if they do, fine, but if they don't, it's okay. So we are saying religious system is a kind of accreditation of institutions and standard generation for those institutions, which is formal, which is legislated, and therefore we know consequences of non-accreditation if it is happening. We know that this parliament has been able to say such and such an institution has not met the following standards, therefore what is happening at the moment is not happening, because we don't have that kind. Now, we do have this in the form of constructor, but that's not the form of government. Secondly, so if we say this office, it might be working with constructor, it might be not. Those are issues that we have to discuss. But what I'm saying is we must have a formal system of the Office of Standards. So we're not establishing that. It's in there. But also in relation to the ombudsman, again, we didn't have an ombudsman. We have the whistle-blowing system. That's encouraging the public to blow the whistle and to use our number. But they are phoning up. So what happens, and I can tell you this from the effort to national, people trust national more than they have their problems. So you have more issues of which should have been solved at the provincial level or at the local level. A person in a clinic in some corner will call the national or write to the national minister and say, and what will that have to do is to write to the problem and say, what is the answer, and so on and so on. And we have people following that. But it's the same people that are doing other things. So the office of the office person will be able to handle this kind of thing, because the job is to just be able to complain if you're helping them. It's not that it's before. It's just a new thing altogether. Now, finally, again, those are the title comments on the consolidation of men. This matter of foreign professional recruitment, in fact, it is really not true that we concentrate very much on the recruitment of foreigners at the expense of local people. It's not true in three senses. Let me give you an example. We as a department are criticized by many foreign nationals of African origin who are in this country. And I think we're also criticized by members of parliament who represent them from time to time for refusing to actually employ those foreign nationals in our institutions. They may come from DRC, Zimbabwe, everywhere. And the reason we refuse is because we honor the agreement that was reached at the subject level and then at the AU level, but particularly at the subject level, that we shouldn't do the thing that we are actually fighting, the EU, Canada, and everybody else, that they mustn't coach our health professionals without some form of compensation or quid pro quo. Because what happens is we train this health professional at high cost, and then they go away, and we get nothing from our training in that. So if we are going to say as Africa, the developing world, we must stop there, South Africa mustn't become that again in relation to our neighbor. You'll see how many health professionals here, particularly in the Western Cape, are from the DRC. They come in Spain and they stay here. Obviously, for very obvious reasons. Unfortunately, the consequence when we can't employ them, then they use, and that's one thing they do, they use half of the conduit for moving to the UK or to all these other places. So the ministers are discussing that. But therefore, just as an illustration, you would say that we do not recruit from Africa. That's full stop. From any other country, currently, we would actually select the countries that we recruit from on the basis of what the Health Professional Council says about the quality of those people. So we send the Health Professional Council to go there, look at the curriculum, look at the people there, and see whether
these things are actually compatible. And if they are compatible, then through agreements that we reach in those countries, we can recruit in those countries. So we don't have an open blanket recruitment that says foreigners can come to work, and we do not. Thirdly, even with regard to those countries, it's really to fill the gap we have in our system currently. Why is it all these issues that make people go and work in the private sector outside, such as issues of retention, conditions of service, etc. So we have a whole range of things to do. Of course, it's very easy for people to say, well, it comes to the private sector, but we can tell you what sometimes it means. So, you know, what they mean by saying it comes to the private sector. They mean employers on our head. We are business. But you should actually employ us on our head. Many of the GPs who are there could actually work in the public sector. I'm not going to speak ill of them, because I think my friend, Dr. Mustafa, he's working very hard to create those relations. So safe to say that we are working on how to actually reach some mutual understanding so that they can be offset, so that we use the human resources that are there in the country. It's not that by excluding them to stay alone to the street. Can I ask Dr. Mustafa to pick up on the other issues? If there are any rules, that would be Dr. Mustafa.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chief. I'm not going to remember. Maybe to start with the last one. What we're trying to do in terms of improving, you know, the conditions, is to look also at those, especially general practitioners, pharmacists, and so on, and who might be working independently to work in the public health sector, but to improve and move away from a situation where it was just a transactional relationship. People come, provide a pair of hands, and then, you know, using their brain, leave afterwards without taking responsibility. So we're trying to come up with a system that would make them take some responsibility. That's the difficulty. A general practitioner with a diploma in pediatrics, then we're thinking that it would be a good idea to give that person a responsibility to run a clinic for children or something like that, so that we don't have to pay people for being there for 2-3 hours and this kind of thing. But the question of recruitment of health professionals is a long-term issue, which is linked to production of health professionals. That is why in the slide, one of the, of the activities we're looking at is the capacity of our own institutions to produce health professionals that will be in tremendous services for the country. There's been a decline over the number of years, not in students per se, but more in the faculty, people, teachers. And that takes me to the question of the opening of nursing colleges. Maybe just to add to what DG has said, is that about 1.5 years, 2 years back, we did just a situational analysis of, you know, the nursing colleges, which was not very detailed, in a way to respond to the marching orders of reopening of nursing colleges. One, we found that not many nursing colleges were actually closed. Instead, they were amalgamated together, some of them incorporated to provinces, to universities. Some provinces, like Gauteng, looked at reopening Libone College, and they needed about 50 million rand to be able to do that, which was not in their budget. But one of the interesting things that we found was that it was not only the question of the physical infrastructure. You had to deal also with the equipment, but more importantly, nursing tutors were no more available. Because a lot of them have left the public sector to run private nursing schools, training nursing assistants and so on. So when you then have to go, you've got to look at who is going to teach. There is no scarcity in terms of students who would want to enroll. But also the other issue that came up, which was a challenge with the nursing colleges affiliated to universities, is that over a long time there'd be no standard qualification for a nurse educator. which tells me that we have done the testing and completion more than training. Now, in terms of university conditions, you cannot lecture unless you've got at least a minimum of an honors degree. That's something that we've asked the nursing profession to look at, and that is in terms of the nursing strategy that was developed last year. On the question of recruitment of nurses, either for work or for training, that really depends on the provincial strategies, but certainly we take the proposal that maybe we need to look at that so that it can be harmonized across the country. Now, to deal with one other issue which was asked, who should the hospital be, or a health professional or non-health training professional? Our view is that we cannot be absolutely strict now, but whoever manages, I mean, a hospital, has to have competence. In terms of, you know, broad management, especially financial management, and also having insight and understanding of the health sector. Because the health sector, in our view, is very diverse and very complex. And also, those people have to be skilled in managing people. Because managing health professionals is one of the most difficult things. I mean, whether they be lawyers, engineers, certainly I think doctors are the most difficult to manage. in terms of the minimum qualifications, we're getting assistance from universities like VIT and University of KwaZulu-Natal, where those hospital managers are being trained. Some of them have got some basic training already, but they are usually slotted in the master's and public health program so that they become, I mean, a part of that training. And that management program has been linked together with the French hospital management program that is well known across the world. Now, to deal with poverty,
before you pass on that one, on a remarkable point, the census 7% therefore does not mean that there is no qualification. It means we are improving the quality of management. But of course, the qualification of CEOs is learning from in some instances, because they don't say to be a CEO. The minimum qualification is like me, you know, they're director. Most of them be a back level, upward. They might need the minimum qualification, but that's really the minimum. They're having a certificate. So there are other qualifications that sort of attracted the country. So that the question that we should be asking the country. The question that is not just for CEOs in the public sector, that is both of you in the university. Would you get somebody into an SMS, into a management system in the public sector? Unless they go through the public sector course, they actually qualify the public sector like media and everything. So that's a stage of development in the public sector. At the moment, we are concentrating more on in-service development. But part of the investigation about whether we should be talking about people in management, not only, but particularly hospitals, in management, having to undergo a certain minimum qualification, training, which is actually provided in a kind of public sector college or a health college or something. It's an issue that is under.
Now,
I think the time now. Now I need to contact the owner. Whether we go on and think about that, or we can't just say now, because there are promises and there are not the second round of questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that people who are in, they want to ask questions.
Yeah.
Or the other one is to cut you short. But everything number one has information. So I want all the members to help me. What do you do? In a quick
I think the question we can finish the answer with.
I hope in very short, okay, continue.
Very quickly, what is OSP? OSP is the new system that we're bringing in to address two major areas. One is to retain health professionals in the public health service and to recruit back as far as possible those who have left public service. I'm saying as far as possible because we know that certain categories that it will be difficult to get them full-time, like specialists, medical specialists, and so on. So what the system addresses really is a number of issues. The first one, which everyone is concerned about, is the question of salary, improving salary, addressing the career path, because those have been a problem within the public service, pay progression, harmonization and standardization across the provinces, because part of the problem is that you may be qualified with the same number of, I mean, a year of experience, but depending on which province you are, you can be treated differently. And also, you know, that we address, you know, all those issues linking in performance management. For most clinicians, there is no performance management of notice, which is why you find somebody being on the entry notch, you know, of a salary band for over 5 to 6 years. Because there's no performance management that has been put in place. So what we then do is that this system is driven by a model for each of the professional categories. Which means that we get a model that talks to nurses, a model that specifically talks to doctors, pharmacists, and so on and so on. For simply one reason, that our view is that it's not one size fits all. The way nursing services are organized, even the education qualifications and so on, are different from the way that they are done for audiology or for pharmacy and so on. So basically, that is what the OSP is about. I think the unfortunate part is that people have looked at the salary and picked that one up and left the other one. Our own view is that you can do a salary adjustment unless you address these other issues that I raised. You will be back at square one within a year, not even a month. Now, in terms of the phasing in, we're basically given, you know, $3 billion over a 3-year period by Treasury. And it was stated clearly that we utilize $500 million in the first financial year 2009-10, $1 billion in 2010-11, and $1.5 billion in the last year. Now, to address medical doctors alone, that would take more than $500 million. But in terms of the agreement, bargaining council, the public service bargaining council, we needed to address doctors, dentists, pharmacies, and emergency medical customers. So if you were to take that 500 and level it on doctors only, you would actually be left with these three, getting absolutely nothing. So then what we tried to do was to fit in, you know, our model within that 500 million and spread it out. And what we could be able to do, which we put as a proposal, is that the most expensive are the medical doctors. Therefore, we propose that we phase in their OSP over a 2 to 3 year period, which basically means that in the first year, it would be just getting everybody, you know, I mean, to correct and harmonize across the country. Then in the second year, you do the individual translation. Then the last year, you bring in other factors like experience and so on and so on. Now, but for the dentists, the pharmacists, and EMS, we could be able to do them in year one because they're not very huge in numbers. And also, you know, in terms of what it would cost, it would not be that much. So basically, that is what it is about. Then for 2009, we need to deal with the other, you know, groups, radiotherapy, physiotherapy, and so on. Basically, what we're trying to do, Chair and committee, is to make sure that we move away from a situation where health professionals, not only in terms of salary, but also the condition of service, that treated the same as anybody else, you know, that is really in the public service. Secondly, Chair, we promise that we will get an opportunity to provide a detailed
pain prevention on the OSD, you know. So that we'll be able to deal also with a number of myths and legends that are making to the relation to OSD. Thank you.
Your last question about contingency. It's a very quick question. I think government is able to contingency through the adaptation of the system, but the narrow idea, for example, from the start, is a colonial situation. That they come and say, unforeseen and unplanned for a situation, and therefore you go to parliament to procure. So you don't need to keep the money. So the only time you deal with that situation is by coming back to Parliament and say, I have had, like in the report, this was unforeseen, you know, and then Parliament is approved.
That's
the problem,
right? So going to Parliament for two,
you said that.
Can look at the road to water last question. If we could be short, yes, and who else of our family. So is that only three questions? One question per year. Okay, it's only four. Okay, you can start now. Then you are going to follow up.
My question is about this option. Certifying appeal to the department has make sure that members get the children more committee or supervision. And then the first question is on the challenge number one. If that is answering the question relating to professional medicine, maybe I missed that one. But my question is on the two number of 4.5.1. You talk about the training of hospital support, which is an ongoing process that I know that only working for in terms of training. But I wonder whether you do also include the traditional ideas. Yes. And then the second one is on page 15. I'm not going to talk to my presentation of the armpits or armpits office in terms of improving the quality of service on page 15. Whether this office is going to be based in Ashna. And this office is effective. But I would like to know the kind of intervention that this office has when they receive all the complaints. The last question is not a question, Chair. I just want to ask if you could give us the details of the hospital you spoke about in terms of the three hospitals performance. You said if we need those details, we can provide to members. It will really assist members when we do our oversight to know where these hospitals are. Thank you.
Thank you, Sir Peter.
I wanted to know, because there is this thing that you think of, maybe it is my own observation, whereby you see that the instructor, the human resource, is bigger at the head and very lean at the feet. Whereby I would just like to give a scenario of the program, whereby you do have a chief director for strategic program. Under her or him, there is a lot of directors, under them, a lot of deputy directors. But when you go to the district health system, you find that there is a director and deputy director. And most often, there is this thing of showcase of staff, and there is this thing whereby you find that the personnel budget doesn't tie with the own body. And at a certain stage, you find that there is an SP under the FDA, DDG, all these things. I just want to really know how are this, how can we do, because we do have shortage of stuff and we don't have money at the end of the day. Then another thing is ensuring 100% primary health care supervision. With the constraints we are having, are we really realistic? Because there is no medical, be it subsidized card or full card at the end of the day, and at a certain stage, there is shortage of personnel. And you find that now we no more have supervision, we have visit. And a visit and a supervision is not really as intense as it's supposed to be. There is this thing which is an old thing, deterioration of health infrastructure. The relationship between the Department of Health and Department of Public Health. Because we know that the renovation, the whatever is happening as a maintenance is being done by a public work. And I think everybody knows in this house that public work is not doing what it's supposed to do. And I know that on our science system, we are going to see lots of things we cannot correct. I would like to see if there is a plan, are they engaging with the public work, so that at the end of the day, this thing of deterioration of health infrastructure must be an action taken.
Thank you, sir. And my question is on page 10, 4.10, bullet 1, on the issue of strengthening research and development. The department says that there's a research for on infant mortality rate. What I'm thinking of now, and also there's a plan to introduce dual therapy for PMTCT, and also the strengthening. I'm sorry about that. I say page 10, 4.10 bullet 1, on the issue of mortality rate, infant mortality rate. The department says that there's a research on infant mortality rate and also plans to introduce dual therapy for PMTCT and strengthen it for these infants. Noting that there's also high mortality rate for young adults, I don't want me to assume as if maybe it's because of the opportunistic diseases that are related to HIV and AIDS. Are there any plans for the research also and the reduction of the young adult mortality rate? Noting that those infants also, maybe those young mothers, have this mortality rate because of the pandemic disease of HIV and AIDS. And also that is why the infant mortality rate is so high. I thank you.
I think I've partly been covered by other speakers from the honorable members, but the new quality assurance system is very quiet. What are the developments in relation to that? And how well is it coordinated into the new monitoring and revision patterns that have been established as far as that's known? And then the other point is the fact that when it comes to issues of the budget, doesn't matter how high we jump, but there are some of the gaps that we've got in relation to budgetary issues, whether we can achieve much. Now, what I'd like to know from the department is the DG could have engaged with us, and what attempts have been made to try and convince National Treasury to have mercy on them in terms of increasing their budget. But we're understanding that that budget in any way is covering in terms of minimizing their cost, or in a way improving where they're having constraints in trying to close the gap. I'm aware that the gap is too wide of what the shortages are, but is there anything like that? And very little, there was a mention of the Italian donors, if I can call them that, getting funding. Those donors, is there any way, but not necessarily the Italian aid, but we could even be in San Francisco, we find that there's two great funds that come into the country. Is there any education or any policy in place to help us control that, to ensure that when budgets need to be redirected in a centralized manner from national department to ensure improved local service? Thank you.
I prefer some of the significant people, but the one data document.
Just a bit to repeat, we forgot your question. The 5 budget. You'll note that probably 5 is where most of the constitutional funds are. So those are both internal, and that's why I start analyzing from the department. Now, with regard to the same of traditional leaders, yes, there is a priority to work with traditional leaders. First of all, to establish finally the Council of Traditional Leaders, which is what we're going to be establishing, and then to do training for those traditional leaders in terms of their council, professional council. But also, traditional leaders are being trained, or are also training themselves. In relation to other methods, in collaboration with health departments in the province, for example, in the area of HIV and AIDS, and in the area of medical countries, in the separate sector, various programs of training that are related to the activity. The office, the Ombuds Person office, at the moment is a national office, which would actually look at the whole range of issues. So it is similar to the Office of the Public Protector, which is a national office, is able to investigate all the whole range of other issues within our capacity. So it will have to develop capacity in order to deal with the matter. With regard to the matter of force of public administration, we will provide this at some point. In fact, it would help us also for our planning. If the committee will be able to plan this program. This is a very unquestioning body, and then we'll have much more confidence quickly on this issue. But we can provide this information, and that's required in one page, including the information about how to pay for the taxes, etc. The issue of top heavy structures, maybe structures that are perhaps very heavy on management and very little on people who are operational. I think it's an issue that we try to handle at the National Health Council level. Have to look at what's wrong, because as again, we are not known with the standards that are related to our economic transition structure and process. It depends on the money they have and how they want to organize themselves, but we would want to deal with that. The 100% PhD supervision relates largely to the fact that we do is identify the supervisor of the structure and be able to say so and so is the responsibility of supervision. At the moment we can't. Therefore, if they are able to say but they are supposed to do supervision visit of that later 5 and I couldn't because the problem of infrastructure, it must be clear that that was the problem. At the moment we just don't have the kind of supervisor arrangement. In some problems, because the structures are so demolished, so they don't do it at all. So we're trying to say critical PhD is actually the level of supervision. At the moment, it's a 60%, I think. So we're moving to 100%. The issue of research, look, with regard to programs to deal with let me step back and say, the reason why you have infant mortality as an issue is because it's quite related to the Millennium Development Goals. And if we can't measure in order to report on those goals and agree what is the infant mortality rate of this country, then we have a problem. So it's because of that it's highlighted in the South. It doesn't mean we don't have other research activities. They're quite below. For example, that's the fact that last week we had from the HSRCA report on incidents. It's part of the processes of our research profile. But there are certain ones that we prioritize for specific reasons. At this point in time, we prioritize the infant mortality for the control basis, and we need to resolve this before we are able to report on the Millennium Development Goals. But we also have other work being done on maternal mortality. Not just the young people, but mothers, also related to the Millennium Development Goals. And there are programs to deal with the mortality of young people, which is actually called the red aspect, fatal and late trauma, and other related things. All these programs are important to that. The quality assurance system that we are actually putting in place, if you look at the energy system in the country at the moment, we're still going to have to define it very clearly, as we have, because the office of the minister responsible for monitoring and evaluation in the president, we have to say what it is that we are monitoring as opposed to monitoring that department. Programs, etc. So that whole system is still something that we need to actually clarify. But in the context of that, we in the department that I have in this debate, apart from just establishing the Office of Standards, we're also looking at what form a broad quality assurance system takes. For example, on the issue of accreditation, if you are accredited in a public hospital, what does it mean for the one that is not accredited? What are the implications? Can it be closed if it doesn't reach the level of accreditation? What should happen? So those issues are part of the issues that we have to grapple with today. What kind of quality assurance system are you actually putting in place, and what is it for? And how is it going to be managed? Because In countries where these systems work, it's because the providers, who are the majority providers, meet a certain quality standard. And then they say anybody must be able to meet the standard we are up. Now in South Africa, if you put that standard, the majority of the providers would not meet it. And so when you say they are up, it wouldn't work well. You have to reach a certain point where you say there are mechanisms for people to put in place, unfortunately, because they are public institutions. We have to be able to say what is the role of parliament in that. So when you say out, you mean who says out? The parliament or is it the quality assurance board? When the quality assurance board says out, how does parliament ensure that the rights of the system is done? All those issues are for what you're discussing in quality assurance. What attempts have we made to convince them that we are in a constant conversation?
You don't know how to go to
treasury. Outside
of treasury office.
For example, we have managed to in the constant conversation to say that we can put another offer on the table after the one that was decided by Dr. Mashat for all. Sometimes it's a very hard job, but we are in constant. We take a view as a Department of Health that we don't want to pressure. So it's not our view to do that, because it's our government. We engage. Let's put it that way. The 4% of expenditure is the National Department of Health. Apart from the fact that the Theopold site of the election is linked to programs, and so all we are asking is for those funds to actually be given back to us. So they are going to be given back for those specific programs. For example, Bumala, they have a specific program for forensic pathology, and they're supposed to innovate those forensic laboratories or mortuaries. And if that money is taken elsewhere, then they'll never innovate. So we're asking for that money to innovate something like that, to protect it up. The issue of donors, there is no, except for the broad country policy about how we relate to other countries, there is no specific policy that says this is how the funds will flow from a donor to national. We have rather a forum with them, a national coordinating forum for donors, where we have a conversation about how to work out how they come in, where they supplement, where they come in, so that they support the priorities of the country rather than creating their own. It's an ongoing conversation. We're getting better, I think, with the donors, and I think we will get some.
But I think let's call it a day somehow. We'll discuss it about it. But I suspect that as I said, I'm repeating something that I said that was new. Maybe we name it. We are new in this portfolio committee, but we know what is needed by our people. So we need a day where you have also explained to us some of those concerns that are coming from the members. Probably we'll tell you that day. I suspect members, we are looking at the budget. And I'm hoping that you agree that this budget can move, and then we'll be calling you very soon just to finalize the thing. We'll just be calling members. Probably the question in our system and then we can go and debate it in Parliament. As far as this panel, I think we are here to overthink it. But at the same time, when we see that there are problems, we will find that this. I have a belief that we need to meet with the portfolio committee of finance. Because some of the things, much as we don't have the best them, but if you don't have the best them, the best you will be on you. But I think we need to make them understand what else. Some of it they don't understand. So we need to tell them. So thank you very much. Thank you very much, even our president. Next time we'll be discussing the public private partnership. Very especially what's going to be happening in our body and that. So thank you very much, number. Thank you very much, Reverend. And you said we don't have funds. We are complaining about funds. We don't have funds to prepare that for you. So you look after yourself. You are fine. I want to take advice of you, Reverend. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we will definitely. Yeah. Okay.